And we're live. Welcome to another edition of the PBJ podcast.
Hey guys.
It's Friday.
Good to have you back in the
studio.
Yeah.
I gotta come back. It's a special episode. I was like, I gotta get back in the studio for our special episode.
Yeah, this is gonna be
A big one.
Yeah. Long day. I know Steve's got a few things here. So
Steve has been working hard.
A lot. The last 24 hours.
What have we been doing?
Well, actually trying to survive the heat. I've been downing my electrolytes nonstop. Actually, that's its own story. But that's been my number one
issue. It's not that hot here, is it?
Sadly, I become more and more affected.
Oh, you're sensitive to it now.
Yeah.
Okay.
But anyways, more to come. But where do we jump in?
Where do we start?
I think we're going to spend the whole show basically talking about the Bitcoin security incident, cold card. I feel like everyone in the community has been on Twitter the past 24 hours discussing it.
The
first thing I'd say is just my heart goes out to everyone affected by this.
Yeah, it fucking sucks.
And we'll get into the details, but unfortunately, I think it's sort of only gotten started in terms of theft and impact on people. Mm. but the last count I saw, like over 1,000 BTC.
Wow.
So, something like 65 million plus. Wouldn't surprise me if it's 100 million by this point, and that could keep exceeding. So this is a big security incident. So feel awful for those people. Mm-hmm. And I mean, one thing we can talk about throughout the show is this feels like the worst day in Bitcoin's history.
Really?
I'll make that claim. Because
that's a big claim, yeah.
Because there's been there's been security incidents before. There's been thefts and loss of funds. All of those are tragic and horrible. This one though is self-custody.
Yeah.
And it's a very serious vulnerability. You know, it was people doing it the right way.
Right.
Doing what they'd always been advised. Cold storage, right? And cold card is a product that's known for its like power features and extra security features. So it's hard to blame the people who chose that path to secure their Bitcoin that they did something did something wrong. So later in the show we'll talk about like the future of self-custody and the impact on that. But certainly part of that discussion is like how big a setback will this be for self-custody?
Yeah,
and I would argue self-custody is an essential option. We need that option in Bitcoin for Bitcoin to be healthy long term.
Yep.
So that's why I'd make the claim that it might be the worst 24 hours in Bitcoin's history.
Totally. And I'm sure you've got a lot of this outline, but to me, the other biggest story, there's a lot of ways to think about this. And I think it's good that everyone think through things with a calm and clear head, obviously. But I think to me, the even bigger story is, you know, while everyone's been kind of afraid of quantum coming, to me, the big story is just AI. Like you're saying, there's a lot more to come with cold card, sure. But I mean, I will say I have in my own personal experience, you know, as you guys saw yesterday, I actually did have some sort of anxiety during all of this because I think, you know, it's cold card today, but what's to stop us from believing that, you know, the successor to Fable 5, and to be clear, like make no mistake, this is a direct result of AI getting better, is going to be able to find some other weird vulnerability. Like to me, the biggest takeaway from all of this is not an indictment of any single company or anything. The biggest thing to me is, and I know you guys have been pushing this, so kudos at Block and with Loop and everything, but like the Bitcoin ecosystem has to get access to the absolute cutting edge frontier models in stealth, full stop. Yeah. And to me, like wherever I would feel comfortable custodying, whether it's self-custody, custodian, really comes down to who do I know is getting access to the latest Anthropic and OpenAI models, full stop.
Yep. We'll definitely cover that in depth. I think that's a really important topic. Maybe we start with like, if people are listening and they haven't been
just kind of
watching
catch up
Twitter,
on what's going on.
You know, the past 24 hours, what are we even talking about?
Yeah.
So we're talking about a very serious security incident. Cold Card is a popular brand and product that's they've been around at least a decade, I think. It's a hardware wallet for people to store their Bitcoin. And yesterday, I think it was around morning or early afternoon Pacific time, I started seeing tweets by credible people like Kevin Loach, who I've known for a long time, credible person in the Bitcoin space, tweeting that he had been hearing from people that they were noticing their funds were gone.
Yeah.
And they were using cold card. So, and he's the kind of person who doesn't like troll tweets.
He's not
and he runs a security like advisory firm in Bitcoin. So, you know, if he's tweeting something, you kind of take it seriously. So that raised some awareness. And then throughout the day, you know, more and more people are researching it, and more data and evidence coming about. And it turns out that many cold card products are affected. We'll get into some of the details, but some are easier to hack than others. But as I already mentioned, the last count I saw, over 1,000 BTC have been transferred. And it's observable on chain through a very clear pattern that lots of independent people have discovered and shared.
What is like the TLDR in the pattern? Is it just like that they're larger transaction sizes, or?
I couldn't tell you all the details of that pattern. I know, I mean, they're looking at like certain signature types and stuff like that. Okay. There's also, I know there's a fixed fee of like 30 sats per V-byte or something that was common across all of them. But there were some other details.
It was much higher than average, right? So you can look at.
Yeah, but there are some other details that made it very, very clear. And so that pattern, but even today, I think there were more thefts, a different fee rate was used. But there's a pretty clear identifiable pattern. In any case, so it's a high impact of event. So what are some of the details of the vulnerability? So there's certain, you know, cold card, there's different hardware products and there's different firmware software versions for the product. So if you have like an MK2 or MK3 version of the hardware and you have firmware that is dated somewhere from like 2021 until I think current, you are at grave risk. It's a very easy reproducible step. Like any of us could just use AI, steal these coins in minutes. Wow. It's very, very weak entropy. So yeah, well, so what's the vulnerability? The keys generated on the device are very weak, mm-hmm. meaning you don't need physical possession of the device to steal the coins. You don't need to have gained access to the seed phrase to steal the coins. You can just look at the blockchain and be able to like regenerate the keys because the entropy is so weak.
How does that like actually functionally work? Like, so they'll see a specific transaction on the blockchain, and what operations, I guess, is the AI crunching to be able to?
Here's what I know. So the bug in this is that the hardware random number generator for those devices isn't being used.
Right.
And that was a compile time bug. When they built the software, they had the code to do it properly, but there was like an if def that was wrong, or if not def or whatever. You know, it built the software incorrectly. And so it falls back to a pseudo random number generator that's software based, not hardware based.
Well, one question on that. I mean, I'm sure everyone now is like looking back and thinking, but I'm thinking for other hardware wallets and whatever. Why is that even an option? Like, if we know that software random number generators are not seeded with sufficient entropy, why is that even an option for any of these?
Well, I certainly can't speak to how they got to that point with their software builds.
Yeah.
But you know, there's at least historically, there's been hardware that doesn't, there is no hardware random number generator.
Right.
You could also imagine building it, like while you're building it, before you have a hardware random number generator there, you might actually build a version of the software that you can test on a local computer that doesn't have that specific piece of hardware you're planning to call.
Right.
So maybe like while you're developing it, you develop it in one way with the intention to flip it on before you go into production.
I wonder though, if in the future of wallet development, people would just cut that off entirely. Like you don't even want that anywhere near your secure element. as an option.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think knowing what we know, what everyone knows now, if you look back, obviously you wouldn't have those errors. You wouldn't have that code, et cetera. So, but in any case, it led to a situation where there was no like cryptographic entropy for the key. That you still have to like, there's still some inputs, like the CPU timer cycle and a few other things, but all of that can be brute forced quite easily. And like the UID, like unique ID with the hardware. So each cold card comes, there's a ID that you can look, if you open it up, that was etched into it from the manufacturing process that's unique. That's also like an input into this key. But if you can brute force all these variables, and it's the deterministic process to generate the keys.
Yeah.
So for those products, and so the coins that have been stolen so far, at least as of the ones yesterday, I think were all from those hardware models, and it's this like relatively easy attack. Then there's been additional research on newer models, MK4, MK5, and Q. Block did a lot of research on this and published a report yesterday, late afternoon Pacific time.
It was really good. It was really thorough.
Very thorough.
Yeah.
So it spoke to the first vulnerability. It also spoke to the second. And these newer models, there is real entropy, like cryptographic entropy introduced, I think like 32 bits worth. So it's much stronger than zero. And so it's not easily brute forced, but 32 bits. I think in total, even today I saw further analysis to try to narrow the window. Because I think in the published report, it's like the range is given like 32 to 72 bits, depending on sort of what the attacker, what assumptions the attacker has. That's a very big range. That's a range from like trivial or you know, like not that much money to millions and millions and millions of dollars. I think they're in the process of trying to narrow that range further. I'm sure if they do and they're confident in it, they'll publish that as well. But this one would be a substantial financial cost to do the attack.
Hmm. But the MK4s, MK5s, and Q could result.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so now I see reports on X of people saying that the MK4, 5, and Q have been hacked. So one plausible explanation of that is like an attacker is trying to reproduce all those keys. And while it might cost them a lot of money to reproduce all the keys, as they're marching along in that process, they're going to find some keys early on.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't take too much time and that much expense to find some early ones. I don't know if that's true or not. That's just a theory, but it could be the case. But then there's other variations to this. So I mentioned earlier, the cold card did have a bunch of security options for power users. So it had like a dice roll feature built in. Like with any hardware wallet, you can generate with most hardware wallets, you can generate your own seed phrase, your own entropy fully. You can just skip their solution and you can just enter your seed phrase,
right?
Which you can generate offline or any other process you want to use. And that could be a good process or a bad process.
Right.
If you know what you're doing and it's a good process, that's one of the most secure ways you can go about securing your Bitcoin. But there's definitely foot guns in that process. But in any case, Cold Card had an explicit feature built in to roll dice. I believe their guidance is rolling like 99 or 100 times.
Mm-hmm.
So to get a sufficient entropy, or maybe it's like 50 or 60 if you want like 128 bit and it's 100 rolls for 256 bit or something like that. But it's not like a 10 second process. You just roll dice a few times and you're done.
Yeah.
You got to be pretty committed to it.
And so doing that to add entropy to the whatever random number generation they came up with. They kind of start with their own seed. Then you're doing that roll.
Yeah.
You're applying additional entropy to.
So even if you had the MK2 or MK3, which had horrible weak entropy, if you rolled a dice, proper, like, you know, properly and rolled them 100 times or whatever, then you actually have sufficient entropy and you're actually not at risk.
And is it generally accepted that kind of any good-looking, reasonable dice is okay? Or do you really need like the super casino-grade dice to get good enough entropy?
It's been a while since I've studied that. I mean, clearly, if there are dice that aren't perfectly manufactured, they'll have some bias in their rolls, and that can reduce the search space. What I don't recall offhand is like how much. and for example, if you do 100 rolls and have a 256-bit security, and you have imperfect dice, does it just reduce it to like 192-bit security? Mm-hmm. Well, my instinct is yes, mm-hmm. but I'm not. Please don't go verify yourself. But my instinct is yes, and then in which you still have very sufficient security.
How does that actually work? So with the dice rolling, so how do you convert that, the entropy from the dice rolls, into changing the words?
I'll answer that in a second. But just one more thing. But I think clearly the most secure way though is to combine sources, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, like advice I'd give to someone who is going to, that I'm confident is going to be diligent enough to do this properly, which is not everyone I know. But if they're diligent enough to do it properly, use the random number generator from the product you buy. And then also add your own entropy with like dice rolls or coin flips or things like that. Do both. Because then if you have imperfect dice, and let's say it only adds like 70 bits of security, which I wouldn't be comfortable with if that's all the security was. But if you combine that with a random number generator, hopefully one that is not horribly broken, then you're going to have sufficient security.
Yeah.
But I mean, is it worth, you know, there's always problems that could emerge when you're sort of relying on somebody else's entropy. Like what if there's something in how the combination works between a dice roll that you are increasing the entropy in the system, supposedly, but maybe the software that actually does the increasing of the entropy has a risk, versus is it not better, like things can go wrong, is it not better to just do the dice roll outside, generate the, you know, the words, and then use those and import them?
Yeah, meaning if you do perfect dice rolls, then you input it to some software that you've not audited, they might have a bug. Yeah, I agree that's a vulnerability. So, I'll get back to your point too in a second. So ways to handle that though is, you know, if you have a multi-sig, and later on in the show we'll get into all the different options that I think are good, so I don't want to get into too much detail, but if you have a multi-sig, you could imagine, first of all, vendor diversity makes sense, so choose different vendors for your different keys, and then for some, you could use the random number generator. For others, you could use your own entropy. That's a way to get diversity, and you're not falling prey to what you mentioned, right? Because like some of the keys would be fully my entropy from dice rolls. Other keys would be not my intervention whatsoever.
That's a good point.
How do you convert the dice
roll entropy to actually change?
I mean, there's different methods. And now with AI, you could ask AI to get recommendations, but. Yeah. I would definitely search for best practices doing this,
mm-hmm.
but there's definitely word lists out there,
mm-hmm.
From credible organizations like EFF and other places that map like five, if you have five dice,
mm-hmm.
and roll the five dice,
they map
you know, 1, 4, 6, whatever, and then it maps to a word. But you need to be very knowledgeable and deliberate about this process.
Yeah.
So I think a very common mistake people would do is that you roll the dice and then you like sort of line them, you move them around and line them up.
Yeah.
Then you're screwing with entropy.
Yeah.
You can't order them. Or like maybe a common instinct would be like, oh, I'll order them like into or like 1, 3, 4, 5, 5. Don't do that, because then you've reduced the entropy. You need to, so like one piece of advice, if you can get different colored dice
or different manufacturers, even.
Well, different colored dice. So each die is a different color.
Right.
And then you write down like green goes first, then yellow, whatever, then roll, and then always stick to that. That would be one way. Or just the way you roll, you just always go left to right.
I think some kind of simpler system is take the dice, throw them out, and don't look at it. Organize them into a line, and then just read the line.
So
don't touch them, no?
No, I'm saying organize them so you, while you're not looking, you don't see what you're doing. You're not trying to do something.
Mm. Yeah, and then you want to be cautious about if you are looking up on a word list, if you're doing it on an online computer, if you're super paranoid and there's malware in your computer, it might know what you're looking at. I mean, you can go to different levels of paranoia
the
there.
The cold card interface for this is actually quite simple. It's much simpler than that. If I recall correctly, I haven't used it in many years, but my recollection is that you can roll a dice and then input a number and roll a dice and input a number. Yeah. So it's, you don't.
That's why it requires 100. So the word list I'm talking about is a different process.
Yeah.
You don't need to roll 100 times. You roll much. I mean, depends on what. If you want 24 words, then you'd roll five dice 24 times, and you get a ton of entropy as long as you follow a proper process. But yeah, cold card. It's a simpler process with a lot of rolls. So anyway, we'll get into more details in a bit. But I guess that's the very high-level description of the vulnerabilities here.
And just to do another zoom out on that, Bitcoin itself does not have any security problems discovered.
Yeah, exactly.
Recently, right? Bitcoin itself is fine.
Yeah.
There's a specific vendor, CoinKite, specific product, Cold Card Mark 2 and 3 and maybe 4, 5 and Q, that have random number generation vulnerabilities.
Yep.
So it's kind of a horrible thing where heart goes out to people who are involved in this, but it's more of a specific vendor problem with random number generation. It's not a Bitcoin problem.
Yeah, and to be clear, when I said at the top that, while everyone's kind of worried about quantum, quantum actually potentially could attack the base layer of Bitcoin itself. Yeah. But I do think it's important to sort of recognize, I do think something in the Bitcoin community a lot of times will go very deep on this one obscure, this thing could happen, when the biggest vulnerability is often just
kind of
the simple things.
Right in front of you.
Yeah, exactly. What are the companies that are doing this? Who's, what AI do they have access to, et cetera?
The one more thing I want to mention, we talked about the dice rolls. So again, just to be clear, so cold card customers who did the proper number of dice rolls and they're confident how they did that, they should not be at risk. Then there's another.
So if you're in that category, you have, say, an MK2 or 3, which are the bad ones, but you've done the dice roll to 100 dice roll or something, you should just sit tight. Don't do anything. Is that kind of the advice?
That is the expectation. If it were me,
yeah, I was about to say, dude,
if it were me, just to sleep better at night, even if I can intellectualize that I'm safe, I still might move funds.
Yep.
But the known vulnerability suggests that you'd be fine, that you're safe. I'll get to some other thinking around maybe advice for that type of a person in that situation as well. But also, let's talk about passphrases. So with the way a lot of these wallets work, you can generate a 12 or 24 word seed phrase.
Yeah.
And then there's a standard called BIP39. It allows for either a 13th or 25th word that's called the passphrase. It's different though than all the other words, because the other words all conform to a specific dictionary. The words have to come from a publicly known dictionary. But if you have 12 or 24 of them randomly generated in a certain order, it's impossible to crack if it's strong entropy. With the passphrase, it can be any string at all, and any the length of that string it's not literally unbounded, because it depends on the implementation of the wallet itself, how long it can be, but it can be a long string.
We call it typically a 13th word, but it really could be a 13th word.
It could be a 50 character string.
Tons of other words in it.
So it can be weak. It could be strong. I mean, it can be 1, 2, 3, 4, or I love you or something. Yeah, it's like a password.
Yeah.
Or it can be super, super strong. It could be 256 bit or more security. So if a person is using a passphrase, if it's strong, secure, and well guarded, then even if you're using this weak entropy seed, if it's 128 bit or more security in the passphrase, you also should be safe. But again, it comes in the bucket. Will you sleep better at night if you move your funds?
Yeah.
So I think probably the right advice is, if you have a product and the firmware version that is at most risk, you need to take immediate action. It's almost a certainty your coins are going to be stolen. mm-hmm. and like within minutes, hours, or days. If you have a passphrase that maybe it's weak or you're not sure, or if you rolled dice but you forget how many times you rolled the dice, or if you have a newer product like MK4 or 5 or Q, you might not have to panic and rush to move the funds like today, but probably within days be moving the funds. But you have a little bit more time to like get a clear head and think about where do you want to move them. I mean, another piece of advice people are sharing, which I think is good advice too, which is, if you need to, or you feel like you need to, or you want to move your funds immediately, it doesn't have to. It can be to a temporary location.
Yeah.
You don't have to like do a week's worth of research to figure right. out the perfect long-term solution for you moving forward. You should still do that, but you can have a temporary holding pattern, and that could be a number of different things. If you're comfortable moving it to a custodian or exchange and KYCing, or if you're moving back to the exchange you bought your coins or what have you, you can go to a River or a Cash App or a Coinbase, etc. There are, if you have like an old phone or old laptop, you could wipe the device so it's a clean slate of software, install some wallet software on it that you trust, move your coins there for a few days or weeks or whatever until you have a better system. Or if you have another hardware wallet, you could do that as well. You could also, even with a cold card, you could, if you don't have the budget to buy a new computer, you don't have an old laptop, or you're not in a situation to do that, you can still use your currently vulnerable cold card. You just need to create a new wallet mm-hmm. using the suggestions from CoinKite and that others are providing, which is roll the sufficient number of dice or create a very secure seed phrase. Also, CoinKite did release new firmware versions.
Create a sufficient seed phrase.
Passphrase. Yeah. Thank you. But also seed phrase. I'm skipping ahead to because CoinKite did release new firmware last night that fixes this bug for most of their products, not for MK3. I think they said the reason why is because that was they had sunset the software for that. So this is speculation, but my guess is it's going to take them a little bit more time to get that software ready because it probably hasn't been part of their process for a while. I think I saw where they committed to also doing that. But so you could install new firmware and add additional entropy yourself and use your existing product and just send your funds to that new wallet. So I think that's the advice that I've sort of gathered from a lot of other people that makes sense to me. But so that's one. Definitely, if you're a cold card customer, immediately spending time thinking about what to do and taking action.
Would you in those cases? Just to be clear, we're talking about applying, like creating a new seed phrase and applying entropy, and we're talking about using a passphrase. And I think the advice I've seen at least says you could do either or. Do you think it's fine to do either or? Do you think like both is?
Well, again, the suite of options, you don't have to do that. You can just move your funds to River or Coinbase or Cash App or whatever. You don't have to generate any of this complicated stuff, mm-hmm. but there's trade-offs of that too. And we'll get to those. Mm-hmm. Max will be a proponent later and we'll talk about the trade-offs there, but that's one option. If you're, and then like if you're choosing some other solution, I mean, there's all kinds of different products, right? BitKey, you don't have to like deal with seed phrases, right? So it's just a very slick, easy user experience. If you're going to reuse your cold card product, which I think is what you're asking, where you are
just
focusing
for
on,
who's, yeah, like
then, if I had a cold card and I, for whatever reason, I didn't want to choose one of these other options, I wanted to reuse my cold card, I would install the new firmware, which fixes the bug. Mm-hmm. If I have an MK3 and it's not available, well, then I can't do that. But I would then either roll dice or generate a passphrase. Definitely one of them. You can do both.
But both is probably better. Like there's not a lot of downside.
I would do both.
Yeah. Again, I mean,
but I would do both. But if I didn't get an MK3 and didn't have the new firmware, so I know that it simply is not providing any security at all, I would definitely do both.
Right.
Because even if I mess up my dice rolls or whatever, or I guess it, if I mess up the dice rolls, it's no worse than no security.
Yeah.
So I would do both. If I installed the new firmware update that uses the hardware random number generator, then it gets debatable whether I dice roll. Because arguably it's better to use the hardware random number generator, plus I can do apply dice rolls for my passphrase.
Yeah.
So then it's a combination of both. I mean, actually, this gets back to your previous question too, like if you mix the two. So if I'm using rolling the dice or generating my own entropy for the passphrase, then there's no way their software can mess with that.
Right.
So I think that's a pretty solid approach.
Yeah, and your answer, someone had asked that exact question in the chat. So whoever asked that, you get your question answered. I would just maybe add the caveat that, I mean, everything Steve is saying, I know you're trying to cover the kind of like extreme cases for someone that doesn't have other options necessarily available. But I would just like have the caveat of like, this is like definitely doing all this is like, if you really want to put in the time, really understand what you're doing, you would consider yourself a super pro user. And even then, I don't know, like increasingly, you know, I know we'll talk more about this in the future of custody and what this means for everyone, but like, you know, I think it's always worth evaluating. Does it make sense, at least until you really have a good plan together, to have someone that's like full-time thinking about this, like at a river or a block, just watch it for you in the meantime? Because I know, I don't know, I wouldn't feel comfortable telling almost anyone I know to do any of this, just full disclosure.
For those of you who don't tune in every week, a year and a half ago, January 2025, maybe like our eighth episode or something of this show, we covered self-custody, the whole show, right? And we talked about different categories, including using a custodian. Another category was using like a Trezor, Ledger, Cold Card, and just following the instructions, like keeping it simple, like what most human beings do, just follow the instructions and use the product. A third bucket was one of those products, like a self-custody hardware wallet, but you spend like 100 hours or more with a do-it-yourself solution. Which is definitely has the ability or the potential to be way more secure, but also introduces the potential for foot guns and requires the patience and diligence of 100 plus hours.
Right.
And then the fourth category is BitKey. And we wanted to compare because BitKey is such a novel design. Yeah. So we walked through all that. And I mentioned this to David earlier, but sadly, the second category, which is using a product out of the box, at least like the non-BitKey product out of the box, doing as you were told, it took a huge hit the past 24 hours, sadly. But in any case.
And I would argue even that third category too. Like, I mean, I get it. There's people that, many people in the community that are obsessed and like spend all their time. And yeah, but I mean, people are still fallible, right? At the end of the day, I would just say, you know, I saw the meme yesterday. And obviously, look, I'm not saying that there's always going to be trade-offs, but if I were advising most people I know, you know, the reality is, and we'll talk about the coin, the honeypots that these exchanges become too, but things like, you know, River, like I know Leishman and his team is 24/7 obsessed with this. I know Block has the best engineers in the world obsessed with this. And even if I'm a really smart engineer individually, I'm still just one person. I know this is dangerous for self-custody and where we think about that in the future, which is why I think, by the way, things like BitKey are going to become increasingly important. But I don't know, man. I think that the thing that just keeps coming to mind for me is no matter how smart you are as an individual, the AI is so much smarter and getting so much better, so much faster that, you know, even with like Ledger and Trezor, like, you know, how do we know there's not going to be firmware or some weird, you know, I guess with Trezor, it's a little bit harder because it's totally open source, which again, kind of pushes the beauty of things being totally open source. I know Ledger is not, more eyeballs, more AIs on it, but I don't know. It's like the meme that showed yesterday, it's like left side of the curve, right side of the curve exchange. And like increasingly, you know, and obviously exchanges have gone under, but I do think the industry has changed a lot since that. So
right now, Steve is making the Michael Saylor, Scottie Pippen look at you.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, I have a lot to say to that, but I wanted to, so
I'm saying for people that probably have not put in the 100 hours, maybe even those people too, but certainly.
I think it's a message we've shared. I think probably that January 2025.
Diversification.
Custody diversification is the best choice for almost anybody.
100%.
Like, you should not say, I'm only doing it this way, because there's just every way has risks and foot guns, and there's always problems that could emerge. So if you really care about this, having multiple different ways that you custody it so that if one goes wrong, you're still in the game.
And right. And put simply, have two solutions, put half your stack in one. Well, just put simply, I'm keeping it super simple.
Yeah.
Have two solutions, put half your stack in one, half your stack in the other. And ideally, those two solutions, the risks of each don't intersect.
Yeah, exactly.
So for
that's the diversification.
100% agree with that.
Like having one be a cold card MK3 with no dice rolls and the other being a cold card MK3 with no dice rolls, that's not diversification,
that's not diversification,
right? So, you know, one type of diversification is like half of your stack is on a third-party custodian and half your stack is self-custody. Two very different risk profiles.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right? And so then it's just and keep it simply again, like with probabilities. What's the probability that one of those solutions will fail? And, you know, it's impossible for us to know the number.
Mm-hmm.
But let's say it's a 1% chance that one of them will fail. Well, if you only use that one, then you have 1% chance of losing all your money.
Right.
If you split it this way, you know, and if Bitcoin moons to a million or more, and it's everything you imagined and dreamt and believed, mm-hmm. and you're hodling, you're doing all the right things,
well off regardless.
You're it's a lot better to have half your stack than 0% of your stack, right?
Yeah, being out of the game is the worst.
Being out of the game,
you just don't want to be out.
So, I think that was our biggest piece of advice a year and a half ago on that show, and it stand now as well. So to people, in other words, people I think get wrapped up into the not your keys, not your coins mantra. And I definitely espouse that. I said at the beginning of the show, if self-custody dies, I think Bitcoin dies.
Mm-hmm. The option for self-custody.
Like a realistic user experience and option for people to use self-custody, if that dies, if culturally people aren't doing it, then I think Bitcoin dies.
Yeah.
So I'm an enormous advocate of not your keys, not your coins, self-custody. But, you know, it would be an incredible outcome if like 50% or more of people with Bitcoin held half their stack in self-custody and half with the custodian. If that if that's a state we achieve, that's
an
incredible state. Really healthy, really resilient, strong network, and that would be amazing.
Yeah.
So, but I have a list of things like advice we should give for what people should do.
One question that came up in the chat. So I was talking about the open source versus closed source. He's saying cold card's fully closed source. I don't think that isn't cold card. Wasn't it mostly open source? And this was open source as well. This firmware.
Yeah, it's open source. I think maybe the confusion here. There was drama in 2021, which actually led to this vulnerability, code being introduced with the vulnerability. Where originally the cold card software was free open source license. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it was MIT or it was a permissive license. And then Foundation Devices was founded. They used that software as they had the right to because it was free open source software.
Yeah.
And CoinKite, didn't like that action and then changed course so that they wanted to have a license which was more restrictive.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're going to commercially use that software, then you'd have to go do a partnership or license from CoinKite.
Got it.
And as part of that, my understanding is that CoinKite had to get rid of the code that was permissive.
Oh, got it.
And have code that was under a new license.
Got it.
And as part of that transition, it was a pretty big transition to a lot of new code, and it introduced, during that transition, this vulnerability was introduced. That's my understanding of that timeline. I believe cold card is open. So it's open source, but it's not free open source. And people can bicker and debate whether the term open source implies free open source.
Yeah.
But it is unquestionably published source.
Open source was auditable.
Open source, no one debates. That means it's permissive. Published source, no one debates. That means it's not permissive or some kind of restrictions. Then the term open source, you can debate what it implies.
And they went from being full open source to not a published source. So you can audit it, you can confirm that it does what it claims to do, but you can't use it to build a competitive product.
Yeah.
Is that roughly why such a thing would be built that way?
Yes. Yeah. And interesting, like BitKey initially was launched with published source with the restrictive license, and then later changed that to be MIT license.
Oh, I didn't realize that. All BitKey's code is FOSS?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's awesome.
That was always the spirit and intention. I think there's just like, it's easy to go it's like a one-way door, right?
Door.
So it's easy to do what they ended up doing.
Right.
And it's, well, as cold cards, the perfect example, it's really hard to go the other way.
Yeah.
In fact, that's a very, very clear example of the risks of going the other direction. So I think it was just like a cautious move by the BitKey team.
To me, the other sort of big meta point, and I know we'll talk more about future and all of this, but is, you know, the beauty and theory of open source is, what is it? All bugs are shallow with enough eyeballs. I mean, increasingly, that's going to be all bugs are shallow with enough tokens, right? And so the thing I keep coming back to is, as a user, the metric I actually am interested in for software I use, like critical software like this, I want to know, who has audited this for how long? Because I know, I believe they did an audit with, I don't know what level of frontier model, maybe it was Kimmy. I don't know if it was one of the closed source models.
Who did an audit?
I think Coldcard did of this release. I'm assuming, I read it maybe on Stacker News in a thread that they had some audit with a model. I don't know what model, I don't know how long.
Audited their
last release to have this or
okay,
whatever release. But I don't know that. That's what I read on Stacker News. No inside knowledge there. But what what I'm realizing, a response in that thread in Stacker News, actually from Nout, I believe, which was an excellent response, was, we're getting to the point now where the state of software is no longer, hey, I did an audit, ship. It's like the attackers are now running instances of the latest software. And you don't know if it's someone from inside a company. I'm not saying they would, but like that's theoretically possible at the very cutting edge.
Right.
And they're doing it 24/7 and like recursively improving their prompts. And so the thing that I'm honestly interested in, and I think this is the much bigger story than an individual hack, because this can go so much bigger for everything in the industry, is, you know, I know we have Project Loop, and maybe Loop needs to be able to do this sort of like verifiably, is I want to see for every code base I use, is there a top of the line model that's running 24/7? And like, how many instances are there? Because like, I think the only way to scale with this, I think the good news is, as we've said before on the show, is that we're going through the transition phase from sort of humans to machines, and it's not always going to be this bad. But during this transition, I actually think a lot, there was a beautiful talk from Drew Bansal, who's done many beautiful talks over the years, talking about how one of the biggest shifts from AI was going to basically be AI starting to hack more software with Bitcoin attached, because that's obviously economic incentive. And that's how like real software, the age of real software would begin, is once, you know, sort of AI's harden it and Bitcoin is the incentive for that. But I want to see like some metric. I want to see like for any product I use, like I'm thinking right now, like if you're using a Trezor or a Ledger or whatever, like, are they running top of the line models 24/7? Do they have people that understand what the attackers are doing? And if not, then I don't feel comfortable with this. So I don't know if there's some way to open source that and like literally show kind of like wallet scrutiny. I think way more important than like old school scrutiny is, you know, who's running, who is the maestro organizing models to validate these things? How many instances are they running? How frequently is it running? Because I know the attackers are 24/7.
So I can share some things we've learned with Project Loop.
Which
makes what you're wanting complicated, but I 100% agree with what you're wanting, and definitely worth thinking through, can we achieve that? But the first point I'll make is around open source. If code is not open, if it's not available, if it's not source available, then obviously something like Project Loop can't even help,
right?
Because Project Loop would not have. And just so people know, if you're not familiar with Project Loop, L-O-U-P-E, Spiral launched it a few months ago with the intention of doing AI security scans for open source Bitcoin repositories. We started with like a set of 8 projects for the initial wave. We've completed that first phase. Now we've welcomed another 10 or so projects, and we're doing regular security scans there. But the source has to be available. Now, if it's free open source software, I would argue that it's better for security, because it's more likely other people will be adopting it and using companies. It in their products. And you need people to care. The more
people, companies, economic value,
yes,
cares about a piece of software,
the safer it's
gonna
be.
More likely someone's going to run an audit against it. And someone's going to look at the audit output, which is what I want to get to.
Yeah.
Because even if, let's say Project Loop guaranteed or could verifiably say we audited the software, that alone, I mean, that should make you feel better than if you don't see that, but that shouldn't make you feel super warm and fuzzy.
I agree.
Because what Project Loop's doing is it's generating a bunch of GitHub issues mm-hmm. in a private repo for the project. So mm-hmm. just the security people or maintainers of a project see the results. Like I don't see the results, even though I'm working on Project Loop. And for some projects, that's dozens of issues being opened. Others, it's hundreds of issues being opened. So what's done with those issues? If nothing's done with them, then it didn't get any more secure. Or if some work was done and some fixes were done, but there was a critical vulnerability that slipped through, it's still problematic. So
does Project Loop publish either the models used and or the prompts used, or is that considered something that...
The harness and the prompts is all open source. Anyone can run it, and it's generic prompts. There's not specialized knowledge in the prompts.
Mm-hmm.
The AI security scanning is good enough that works. That said, like if you know, like with the cold card incident, when you know the specific vulnerability and you know that, and you now mm-hmm. you want to go test like Trezor, Ledger, yep. BitKey, other products, like prompting it very specifically to focus on that can radically shrink the time and cost to find it. But you, with Project Loop, we don't go in knowing that, this is where the bug is. Well, we don't know where the bugs are. Yeah. So it's a generic prompt. That's all open source. The models used is not published. And I'll just say that the project tries to get access to the most powerful models possible because mm-hmm. we want to do as good a job as possible and help projects become, we're the good guys. We're not trying to.
It almost seems
these
like
projects.
Every time a new high powered model comes out, it may be able to do
crazy new
it
stuff.
Almost feels like you might need a new audit, a new Project Loop.
I would even push further on that. To me, the big takeaway from that now comment was I don't even think it should be a dynamic process. Like I think you should be able to see in real time for things that are important enough. It's not like, there's a new model, new audit. It's like, no, I want to see 24/7, 365. Continually crunching on the prompts.
So, if one thing is, or you mentioned, you saw that like CoinKite ran a scan or not. I didn't see that, but I don't know if they did or did not. I do know, I have heard others did scan cold card firmware earlier this year and did not find this bug with a less powerful model.
Yeah,
with a less powerful model.
With a less powerful model.
That's the issue.
And now, like, I know many people, like, Instagibbs on my own team reproduced this yesterday. It took him an hour and 50 minutes, he published. Like from the time he's like, I wonder if I should try mm-hmm. to look into this. Hour 50 minutes later, he also had an MK3 hardware, actual hardware himself.
Interesting.
And he completely reproduced the vulnerability and was able to generate 24 words.
And was that ChatGPT 5.6 Sol or Fable 5 or something that just came out in the last few weeks?
It's a newer model. Yeah,
newer than those. Private access.
I can't say.
Okay.
Well, this is something that I do. I know you can't say this now, but like, especially for the exchanges, also like, seriously, like, I want to see specifically. I would use an exchange that says I got access to GPT-6 or Mythos competitor before anyone else over anything else. That'd be my number one requirement.
But then they might lose access to that model.
Then keys are going to be a hard thing to do.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. What we're seeing so far, these models, obviously, everyone seeing that they can do magical stuff and find bugs that humans haven't found for many years or decades. But that doesn't mean, and also generic prompts work. But that doesn't mean that it's perfectly spitting out, like, there's three vulnerabilities. One's critical, mm-hmm. one's medium, one's low, and then that's it. It's like there's a lot of noise and it'll misclassify the severity both ways. It'll say some things are high when they're low. It'll say some things are medium when they're severe. So it requires humans to look at the output still.
and it requires humans who understand the code base. That requires attention and people who care and people who are prioritizing this stuff, which gets back to the more people that are using a piece of software, it's more likely to get more attention. So that's still important. I mean, the models are going to keep getting better. So, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if by the end of the year or a year from now, it will be, it spits out the, because the other things, it'll find legitimate bugs, but yeah, they're not security vulnerabilities, right? So among these like dozens or hundreds of issues, it's pretty accurate in all of them. Like they're all like issues, but sometimes it's like, well, but actually the compiled, that's only if you compile it this way and that's right, for debug or, no one does that or, things like that. In any case, the other thing I was going to say, you're saying like 24/7, 365 or whatever.
Important enough.
Well, that's it. So another thing we're learning with Project Loop is that it costs money to run these models.
Right.
Yeah.
And we're also learning that different models cost a different amount of money and some cost a lot of money. So, we're having to establish like tiers and frequency of rescans and also what you're rescanning. Mm-hmm. So like, are you rescanning the entire code base every hour? Or, are you only rescanning, are you only scanning like new code?
Right.
So there's all these variables we can play with to make it so that the quality is still high, but it's like practical economics.
There's also a lot of like third-party library inclusion in software, right?
Yeah.
And so
it's there might be your
things
fault.
That you kind of like accidentally include. It's like, oh, how do you compute thing X? Oh, there's some library that computes thing X. So I'll just like include it. You trust it kind of works. So being able to figure out like how much of those libraries get included and should those get their own loop projects or the whole way software works.
Well, and to be clear, I mean, as much as the loop thing is amazing, I really think you guys could play like a world-changing role through this transition. But also, there's also the economic actors, right? Like, I want to see, and I know we're going to talk about this as well, but like Coinbase, those guys have a lot of money, public company. How much is being spent right now? Are they getting access to GPT-6 or whatever Fable's successor is? And if so, I would hope they're running 10,000 instances of these models 24/7. I bet they are too, but it would be cool to know that.
Right. Yeah, they might not be able to say, but
exactly. But then it's like, so, one thing that I come in, part of the spirit of self-custody, it's not just the self-custody piece. I think to me, what's very important, obviously the right to self-custody, but also is transparency. Like, I think one of the most valuable things that we could do or could be done in general for individuals is just be able to know, okay, I have all of your different options out there, like who's cutting edge, like getting this and who's not, because I really think it's that black and white. Like maybe they can't tell us, but then that kind of puts the end user in like a not a great position.
Yeah. Yep. So we're an hour in and I really want to get to advice.
Already, wow.
Everything we're talking about is great, but just advice for people, because we already gave some advice that we've learned and makes sense to us, I think, for people who use a cold card themselves. But I think I have advice for everyone in Bitcoin who cares about Bitcoin, who holds Bitcoin or believes in its future. Mm. Every single person should take action right now.
Okay.
And that action is that if you know someone who uses a cold card, or even if you just know someone who has Bitcoin,
that's a good point.
Reach out to them and be, obviously if they have a cold card, reach out to your family members, your friends, your acquaintances immediately to and then collect the most reliable information you can find and share with them. If you have friends that you don't know what they use for storing their Bitcoin, ask them.
To make sure they're aware,
Because while I've been on Twitter constantly the last 24 hours, even you guys haven't, but like you're aware, but there's a lot of people who like live a life, don't work in the space full time.
Right.
And they're like on summer vacation or something, right? And they are at risk right now.
Yeah.
So reach out to your friends and family members. Everyone can do that. So I think that's really important.
Yep.
So, I mean, anyone listening to this show, you're probably equipped to go find like the one, two or three credible pieces of information. I mean, you can certainly like what CoinKite has published and what Block has published, I think is highly credible and reliable. So, you can share that with people. Sorry. I have my notes here.
Excited.
A lot of information to share.
We got
Sorry.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Do you mind? Some people listening or people listening that you know, folks, I mean, if you are like a security researcher or you nerd out on like blockchain analytics, or whatever, I mean, if you're toying with your AI LLM, if you do any kind of analysis that you think would be valuable to that's delivering new technical information about this exploit that you haven't seen revealed yet from CoinKite or Block or anyone else, please report that. Security@coinkite.com is their email. And MVK's told me like that's the place people should share information because they're getting DMs from, they're being flooded with DMs. So the best resource to contact CoinKite is security@coinkite.com. Block is doing a tremendous amount of analysis. And we haven't really talked about that yet, but I had a firsthand view at everything done yesterday. I already knew the Block security team was A+. Because several of them I've worked with for 7 years now. So I know how good they are. But yesterday was a shining example. Incredibly intelligent, knowledgeable. They really care. This isn't Block's product, right? And Block didn't do this as like a gotcha to a competitor because BitKey and ColdGuard are somewhat competitors. Block cares about Bitcoin, cares about the people who are affected.
Yeah.
And including the Block security engineers, also a couple engineers from Spiral as well, put a bunch of time and thought into this. So huge shout out to them. It was also cool to watch them use Buzz in this process.
Oh, nice.
They literally use Buzz. And like I saw first, this isn't like a marketing thing for Buzz. It's just they actually use this tool because each of the security engineers were, you know, doing their AI research on these vulnerabilities, but they were doing it in a collaborative environment.
Yeah,
like previously, they'd be doing it solo in an island. And then they'd have to determine when are they going to share results? What are they going to share?
Right.
And with others, and it just, there's friction. Where here, there was no friction. Everyone's doing the research. It's all searchable.
Right.
It's all available to your own agent to see it all. And it accelerated the process. And then for people who aren't the biggest technical expert, but like comms people and executives and everyone else,
can just
follow along and quickly get summaries and have their questions answered. It was really powerful and amazing.
So that's Block corporate internal. Obviously, that's not meant for public consumption, but it seems like it could be useful to have a Buzz channel. I don't know if this is on Flint or somewhere, a new community that gets popped up, but a way that people in the public who want to participate in not necessarily all the security research, but start to ask questions and try to get the best information.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I know of like several Signal channels that are private doing that, but I think that's a good idea. Like a lot of this stuff can be public. I mean, especially if you're just like an armchair quarterback at home or whatever, or just an independent person, you're not working for a company and have to sort of follow the guidelines or rules of the company. You can join forces with other like-minded and caring Bitcoin people to do that. I think that's a great idea. Big shout out to the Block team. And all that information also was shared ahead of time with CoinKite. But then we felt it was important to publish it as well.
So if you were trying to contact your friends who you think might be affected or loved ones who have Bitcoin, you want to just make sure they understand, is the Block post on that pretty exhaustive about what to do and the advice? Like if somebody doesn't have a chance to listen to the show, but are they not going to share the whole show, would it be to share that one link to the Block post, or is there another?
I mean, I think the two most credible things would be CoinKite Communications. That is the company behind this. So their official communications. I mean, they do have blog posts outlined. I mean, and you pointed this out before the show. I mean, NBK literally says, move your funds off his own product. So you know it's serious. If the founder and CEO and a person who has spent a decade of his life working on this product is saying, move your funds off of it, it's serious. So just that alone, I think, is what I'd share. But if I think the block engineering post, it has more and better detail and also highlights risks with some of the other products that I haven't yet seen CoinKite emphasize yet. So I think that would be a good share as well.
On the Buzz community idea, I wonder, maybe it's under Project Loop or something else, but it'd also be interesting to see a community where people could come together, propose projects that need to get audited, companies that need to get audited, help reach out to those companies, bring those people in. Because I'm just thinking right now, like, you know, there's whatever, dozens of companies in the Bitcoin space. Now, granted, most don't have that, you know, that great of an assets under management or whatever. But like, for like the long tail of these companies, like, is there a community to like identify them, reach out to them, bring them into the mix? See, are you running, you know, the latest models? If you're not, can we find a way to help you do that? That seems to me like that'd be extremely high leverage.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about like what can be done to try to minimize the damage. The reason why this is such
the
a severe...
blast radius, if you will.
Yeah, the blast radius.
If you're using too many LLMs.
What makes this so challenging is that most software vulnerabilities, like 0 days or something, I mean, they can be really severe problems, but a software patch can be released and you update and then you're protected, right? That's, I think, for most people, that's what you experience. And, you know, so hopefully you weren't impacted in that narrow window of time in which it was publicly known and exposed. This is not the case here, though, right? If you're vulnerable and you just upgrade the firmware, you're still vulnerable,
mm-hmm. right?
Because your key was generated in the past.
Yeah.
It's vulnerable, and just upgrading the firmware doesn't change that key. Doesn't make it strong. Yeah. You have to sweep your funds into a new wallet, transfer your funds to a new wallet. It makes it really tricky, and that's also why that's why it's so important for people to communicate with friends and family and those that they know.
Yeah.
And influencers on, I mean, many podcasters took sponsorship money from CoinKite, and I'm not shitting on them for doing that. But I do think it's their responsibility to tell their audiences about this issue, to just spread the word. The more people that know, the better. Because otherwise, there might be people who don't learn of this for days, weeks, months later, and they're going to wake, you know, it could be 3 months from now. They go check and all their money is gone and they're like, what's going on? And then they'll be like, oh my God, this was discovered 3 months ago. I could have done something about it.
Yeah.
Right.
So spreading the word is super important. What else can be done? Well, in an ideal world, like the attacker can be discovered and found, right? That would be step one. So maybe that happens. Yeah. Even if that happens, number two is getting the Bitcoin back from the attacker. And that's not a given. They could literally just burn the money and it's like gone forever. Or they moved it somewhere and tossed the key in some, you know, farmland and will never give it up. So it's not a given, but hopefully the person's apprehended. The money is claimed back. But what's the third step? So if like the authorities or whatever are able to get the Bitcoin, how do they get it back to the rightful owners?
Show proof, I guess, original ownership.
Well, I have some answers, but I'm curious. Do you have any thoughts before I share some of the ideas?
I mean, if you could sign a message from your, I guess, original, when you created the coin, it's like from that key.
But any of us can sign the same message.
Oh, now you can. You're right.
It's kind of like, you know, we've been going through these mental exercises of quantum. Like, what if there's a quantum computer? Right. How do we distinguish between you, the rightful owner, and me, the quantum attacker?
Really interesting.
It's the same thing, right? So, fortunately, there's some smart folks, including folks on Spiral, but others on Twitter that are in the Bitcoin community who are coming up with ideas. So I'll summarize some ideas. And I think there's three types of evidence that collectively we've come up with that I think do a pretty good job at demonstrating ownership. Mm-hmm. Good enough that I think it could be used if needed. Mm-hmm. One is that I mentioned earlier that each device has a unique ID, UID.
Oh, interesting.
And it used in the generation of the key. So if I come to you and I'm like, here's my hardware, it's the only hardware in the world that has UID 73 or whatever the number is, right? And the only way to generate the key from my wallet is to use the number 73 because it was used in the key generation. And so then we can all look at the public blockchain and see how much money was in that wallet.
Yep.
So I can come to you with hardware that
seems pretty
strong evidence that I had that much money.
Right.
Okay. But it is possible to create fake hardware that has UID 73. So an additional piece of evidence would be, I have an email from CoinKite, you know, from like the year 2023, showing that I'm a customer and I purchased a, you know, cold card MK3 or whatever.
Right.
And it's a DKIM signed email, which means it was signed by a cold card server key.
Do they do that?
We demonstrated it this morning.
Okay.
So I actually bought some Open Dimes in 2023. So I grabbed my email from there, looked at the email header, and it has the signature. And that signature, it signs for the whole, all the contents. So you can't forge like a different email recipient or a different date. So it's cryptographically secure.
That's good.
And then we also checked the current server key from CoinKite. It does verify my email from 2023.
Great.
So, I mean, we should also prove that it goes back to 2021 and still that same key works. But that's another piece of evidence. So if I come to you with this hardware wallet and this proof that I actually bought a hardware wallet, it's not, I don't think the UID is in the email. So I don't have proof that it's that hardware wallet, but I do have proof that you know, 3 years ago I bought a hardware wallet. That's very strong evidence. The third piece of evidence that could be used, I suspect a lot of customers transferred coins that they bought on an exchange to cold card.
That's a great one.
Right. And then so there can be proof from that exchange where you had to KYC that I'm so and so.
Yeah.
And then there's blockchain analysis that shows those coins move from the exchange to the address at the cold card. So I think there's like, that's pretty credible that you could have a process to fairly give people their Bitcoin back.
Yep.
So I don't want to create false hopes for people.
Right.
We do not know if all three of these steps can happen.
But it's promising.
But it's possible.
If you had to guess, is it like 1% chance or 80% chance?
Well, I don't want
to
give false hope. But I think it's plausible enough that, again, a call to action to everyone in the ecosystem. If you learn of anything that can help in any of those three steps,
right.
Like if you think of an additional piece of evidence that could help on on the third phase, please share that, you know, again, security@coinkite.com, or share it with publish it on Twitter if it's if you don't think it's, you know, if you think it's responsible and it's not sensitive, and get the word out. I think it's worth people's time. At least.
I mean, and hackers, I mean, there is precedent for getting apprehended, you know, the Gox coins eventually. I don't know how long that'll take. It could take forever to get, you know, distributed. But
now here's another very interesting thing to discuss. As stated earlier, there's a lot of vulnerable coins that are likely to be stolen still.
So it could be new thieves now.
Well, there's a ton of vulnerable coins that have not been stolen
yet. Right.
And, well, I say a ton. There are people looking into trying to quantify that.
Right.
Like how much, how many wallets, how many coins. But, you know, with what little I know about that question, I think it's material. Like, it wouldn't surprise me if it's hundreds of millions of dollars more that could be stolen. So if there are people who know how to steal these coins. The methods are known now. So if you have, so obviously we don't want black hat hackers stealing the coins. That's criminality. That's theft. It's bad. What if white hat hackers did it?
Yeah.
And combined with, we know if we have a process that, like the community feels overall is like fair and just to get the coins back to the rightful owners, then you can, My own opinion is it's ethical to do that. The white hat hacking and the transfer of funds into a system and a process that would get it to the rightful owners. But who does that, right? Is it even legal? I haven't done the legal analysis. I haven't spoken to lawyers yet and seen legal analysis on that. So I don't even know what the precedent is on that, the legality. But, you know, to me, in an ideal world, like U.S. authorities would be the best positioned. Because they, well, I mean, whether it's legal or not, if the U.S. does it, then the U.S., you know.
It's legal now.
It's legal now. You know, and if it was a transparent process, and if everything I said earlier is like, it pans out to be true and accurate, like that there is a just, fair process for people, and that at least the majority of people correctly get their Bitcoin back. And there's not like a vulnerability. What we want to avoid is a vulnerability in the process where an attacker can exploit that process and get all the Bitcoin themselves. Mm-hmm. Well, obviously that would be a disaster and doesn't solve the problem. But yeah, ideally it's then, because then it's not any like, you know, cowboy like doing it, or, you know, like global cowboy trying to do this, or even a company trying to do it. It would, I think that's challenging.
Yeah, it's interesting.
But in any case, I think that could really mitigate the problem, or it could reduce the blast radius tremendously. So I think that's worth a lot of people thinking about more and coming, you know, smarter ideas and new ideas bringing to bear on that. Maybe last topic is like the impact on self-custody.
Yeah, that's a big one.
I mean, you've already teed up several of those conversations. And, and I had down here like talking about Project Loop. Well, we talked about that. But custody diversification, we talked about that. I had down here, are custodians safer? And that's sort of like your mantra.
I'm not saying all custodians are safer. I'm saying, you know, everyone has their own unique calculus and like how deep they are, what risk they're willing to understand. But what I am increasingly saying, perhaps the one slightly different angle I'm taking on this than most people I've seen or talked to so far is, again, I think the big story is AI. And so my big takeaway is, if there are custodians that are, you know, very, let's say, well-resourced and are getting access to the absolute latest cutting-edge models, at least during this transition phase, that to me seems like a pretty, honestly, you know, promising trade-off. But then again, I don't know. It's hard to know. Are they? How are they? Like, you know.
But I think there's a range of custodians. Like an ETF is a custodian.
Yeah.
You know, a Coinbase or a River are custodians. Mm-hmm. So there's a range of.
But actually,
what kinds of risks you're taking?
All but one ETF is not a custodian. Yeah, Fidelity is the only ETF that's a custodian.
And I think they've also, I think the ETFs have diversified a bit under the hood.
Some.
My understanding.
But still, I mean, you're
launched with Coinbase. I think one used another one, maybe.
Gemini.
I mean, did they use Fidelity?
Used Gemini.
I mean, Fidelity used Fidelity.
Fidelity used Fidelity.
Everyone else
used
Coinbase, and then Gemini used Fidelity? Or?
No. Someone, one of the ETFs, I don't remember.
Oh, used
using Gemini.
Right. Thanks.
And then I think Anchorage has got it added in. There are a few of these, but the point is it's like, five or fewer.
Highly centralized.
Yeah.
So the, and by the way, I'm not, in this discussion, I'm not trying to FUD any particular solution.
Yeah.
Right.
Because we can go,
trade-offs everywhere.
There's trade-offs everywhere, whether it's BitKey or Coinbase or Cash App or River or any of these, there's trade-offs. So I'd say that let's not rehash traditional risks with custodians, but a new risk would be the rise of AI can impact this too. So we just saw a week ago,
AI is breaking free.
OpenAI, a company that is like the world expert at AI systems, had an AI escape from their company.
Exactly.
Unknowingly, it escaped and attacked other companies for a week. OpenAI wasn't even aware.
Exactly.
And they're the experts in the world in AI.
And what happens if the stealer, the thief, becomes an AI, not a human?
Right. So this wasn't like an intentional, it was intentional in some ways. They were intentionally trying to test a new model for its cyber abilities, but they didn't they didn't intend it to go attack Hugging Face or other companies.
Right.
So if like a world expert can't even control their AI, you can imagine a world where, in fact, I mean, it's hard to imagine a world not where Coinbase and Block and River and you name it, all these companies are going to be attacked by AIs.
Yes.
So I think that's inevitable. Now the question is, like, what's the fortress look like, right? The good news is unlike, like with Hugging Face, I don't know exactly what got hacked, but I assume it was only like online computers right. were accessed and something happened. With cold storage, that does prevent a huge barrier
right.
for AI. So that's one reason to like sleep better at night if you have coins at right. River or Cash App or Coinbase or what have you.
You think because they have a cold storage?
Yes.
Yeah, because the AI can't like leap into the air and like access.
Not yet.
You know,
the robots are coming, but
something that's not connected to the internet. But I mean, the robots are coming, but like these systems at you know, more sophisticated companies like a Coinbase or a Block, and
yeah.
you know, for River too, they have layers of security. And I guess my guess would be like the heightened risk of AI probably penetrates some of those layers much more successfully than in the past.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a question of like, you know, are they still blocked at the final layers or not? Are these companies hardening their systems, et cetera? So mm-hmm. there's still that risk.
Which again, I'll just come back to, if there is some way to report to the public from these companies or from a third party, like a wallet scrutiny type thing or something, I would like to know, to the extent that we can know, what are all of these companies doing? Like, are they, you know, 24/7 recursively changing their prompts? Like, do these guys have not just like old school security people, but do they have people that are like using the absolute latest models and are, you know, native to that?
I do agree that it's good marketing from these companies. If they have like engineering blog posts and content mm-hmm. that outline in detail, here's what we do, or here's what we're doing new because right. of the right, new yeah. threats. That would give me more confidence versus a vendor that isn't doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So I agree with that. But at the same time, like yeah. it's still trusting them. And it's not like, I don't think these companies are going to lie about what they're doing.
Right.
But even if you're a security expert and you read all the details, because you still might not be aware of all the holes still that are not being covered.
I mean,
right?
Nothing is perfect. Yeah. Like,
so,
yeah.
Future of self-custody, does this mean the end of self-custody? Well, on one hand, well, I don't think it's the end of self-custody, but I do think on one hand, it's definitely a major step backwards because what percentage of cold card customers are going to move to exchanges now or ETFs?
Most.
Okay.
I don't know about most.
I mean, I don't know what the answer will be, but like I'm not going to tell you that that's wrong.
Yeah.
I hope it's not most, but even if half do, that's we don't have that many people self-custodying.
Right.
We have a lot of Bitcoin that's self-custody, but not people. Like right. a small percentage of Bitcoiners self-custody.
Yeah.
So if we lose half of cold car customers, that or majority, that would be bad. Even if you're using another solution, like you're saying, like, well, how vulnerable is Trezor, Ledger, BitKey, or Jade, and mm-hmm. you know, any other solution? This will probably cause a lot of Bitcoiners who are doing that to like, they might have spent a good chunk of time, like 5 years ago, looking into this and picking the product, and then they're like, this product's the best for me, and then they haven't thought about it since. That probably describes a lot of people.
Yep.
An event like this, I mean, a horrific event, but a positive is it does encourage a lot of people to go reevaluate their security environment.
Systems, yeah.
A lot of things have improved. Like products exist today that didn't exist 5 to 7 years ago, and improvements have been made. Plus, you might have just learned yourself your own setup that you know you would do things differently. So, I think that's a positive. But then I do wonder how many will, even if you didn't have a cold card, but you'll just be like, I don't want to take the risk that my Trezor, Ledger, BitKey, whatever, is going to be next. And then you move it to a custodian. Again, though, I think we get back to custody diversification is probably the biggest piece of advice we could share because there's risks with the custodians, too. There's risks everywhere.
Yeah, there's always.
Choose to yeah. split your stack. Some ratio that you're comfortable with between the two solutions, I think, is the biggest piece of advice we could share.
And do you think that there's something like this was a random number generator kind of problem? Like that was the crux of it. Do you think that that is a big enough sort of thing that you say, look, I'm going to be much better about my random number generation process, but then maybe I'll use it with other tools that are not, you know, it may have different types of risks, but I'm going to isolate the random number generation risk and use sort of other existing tools. Like, is that a good enough way to stay in the self-custody game, do you think? Or do you think it's like, oh, some other exploit can be discovered just as well in some other aspects?
I don't know. There's a lot of attack vectors, right? So I, the one that'll be top of mind for people now is key generation.
Yeah.
So a lot of people before who, you know, weren't maybe even thinking about that attack vector deeply at all, or considering it as a similar weighted attack vector as like dozens of others. Now they're going to be thinking. I've always thought it's like one of the most important things, if not the most important, because, well, for the reasons we just saw, like you generate it and you can't, like it's hard to change. It's hard to change it. Because you're exposed to remote attacks. In fact, I think we talked about in that episode a year and a half ago. There's so much attention, and some companies market this daily, like daily emails from some companies talking about like wrench attacks and physical assaults in person and stuff. And that's very scary. And like none of us want that to happen to anyone.
It's easy to visualize,
but it's kind of like being worried about crashing in an airplane. I mean, the probability is very low. There's not that many incidents. You're most likely to either make a mistake yourself. I think that's the most biggest risk, is you make a mistake yourself. The second biggest risk is a remote attack, because then the person could be anywhere in the world and can attack the whole world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's much more powerful than if you have to like come to everyone's home physically.
Right.
It's logistically more harder, scalable. Puts you at more risk of being caught, right?
Yeah.
So the key generation, I think is going to rise in people's view of like being a really critical attack vector, and you want a solid solution there.
I think it's one of these things, like a wrench attack is very, you can visualize it. You know what that feels like. You can imagine what it looks like. Random number generation, we have a hard time recognizing how bad we are at generating random numbers. They're just like really hard to generate. It's like, oh, I'll just make up a few things. But those are not actually random. Right? Yeah. We're just horrible at making random things, even though we think they're random.
Yeah.
So I think it's just hard to visualize and digest how tough that piece of it is.
Steve, I don't know how much you can speak to this, but you know, specifically, you mentioned, okay, we want self-custody to keep thriving. What are your thoughts on these other, the major hardware wall players? Obviously, you know more about BitKey, Ledger, Trezor. Like, what is your advice if someone's listening to this and saying, "Hey, you know, I got a Trezor, I got a BitKey." Like, how should they evaluate? Like, when I think about AI getting a lot better, is this device going to be safe in a week, in a month, in a year? Versus, should I just go with the? Because I think a lot of people are in that boat right now.
Yeah. So I think something that was true before, true 2 days ago, still true today. Is multi-sig is strong and powerful. And when I say multi-sig, that could be like a 2 of 3 or 3 of 5, or you have like 3 keys or 5 keys and you need 2 of 3 to sign.
Yeah.
Or 3 of 5 to sign. Now, what's very important about such a setup though, is that you have diversity across your different keys. And I think cold card, if I recall, I hadn't used a cold card for several years, but I think they had a multi-sig feature built in, and even like a packaged product where you bought like 5 cold cards for your multi-sig. Now, I think that's, and I thought at the time too, that's a dumb idea, because then you get no diversity. Mm-hmm. So if you have a vulnerability in a particular product, and this is not a slight on cold card, this would apply to any company or any product.
You're not getting diversity.
If you're only using that one company's product, especially if it's the same model and same software, then it's you eliminate the vast majority of value of multi-sig. So having diversity of hardware and software across the keys is really important, and then really valuable too. Because in such a setup, if one of your 5 keys was one of these vulnerable cold cards, you'd be perfectly safe.
Yeah, fine. Yeah.
Right?
Right.
So multi-sig remains very safe and secure. Now, historically, it's been complicated to set up. It's much more, if you're going to do it yourself, or Yeah, if you're going to do it yourself.
Or use a service like Unchained. Or
right. I get, but if you do it yourself, it's definitely more complicated than doing single signature. And I don't think a lot of people do that. So I always get a little nervous using a solution that few other people do.
Yeah.
Because then it's novel.
Fewer eyeballs.
Fewer eyeballs on the process, right? Yeah. And, you know, and if you're developing your own process, you better be an expert and diligent. And even then, it's risky.
Yeah.
So then, like you said, okay, great. There's services like Unchained, Casa, like Nunchuck is a software wallet that supports multi-sig. And there's other products too, but you know, all of those they're all different, but they all help you and assist you along the way. And then there's BitKey, which is multi-sig by default. So it's I believe it's the only product in the market that is multi-sig out of the box. Like Casa and Unchained, I mean, you have to go. They can ship you these products, but it's a collection of different vendors' products that you're kind of mishmashing together, and their software helps you do that. With BitKey, there's pros and cons to the approach because
the con is it's one company.
It's one company, so you lose some of the diversification benefit.
Right.
But the simplicity in UX, no one questions it's by far the easiest product to use.
Right.
The main, you know, criticism or thing you'd want to evaluate BitKey is like the security, privacy, et cetera, both of which have improved tremendously over the years. And, you know, my opinion is it's a really, really good, the overall safety value is high because part of safety is not just like raw security, but are you using the product correctly?
Right.
In elimination of foot guns, BitKey does very, very well at. So that user, if someone agrees with like user error is probably the biggest risk to themselves, like they're going to make a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
If they're like egoless enough to admit that they might make a mistake, then BitKey is a big win there. And then if you look at all the traditional metrics of security, BitKey does really well on those too. It's not without weaknesses though, and I tell the team this, like key generation is an area that could improve. The good news is that there's three keys,
yeah,
and each of the keys are generated by a different piece of hardware and software stack.
Interesting.
So you do get that diversity because one is generated on a block server using a suite of software. Another is generated on your phone using a different set of software on a phone. And the third is generated on the BitKey hardware device using a different set of software. So if there's a vulnerability in one piece of software or one piece of hardware, you're still safe. It would require multiple vulnerabilities, but it's possible, but it's just far, far less likely. But being a single vendor, you know, if there's some kind of rogue employee or external attack into the company, you could insert yourself into the overall process and potentially modify multiple pieces of that puzzle. So there's that type of risk. But the key generation part that I'd like to see improved is it's not independently verifiable right now. And the
How's that? I thought you said it was all false.
Well, the key in the server is running on a server.
Got it. Okay.
It is possible to run on a server, and we talked about remote attestable software on a server. That's possible. So they can do that, but it's right now you can't independently know this software was run on that server to generate my key.
Got it.
You can't do that yet. And then on the phone, on an Android phone, yes, it's a reproducible build. You can do that. You yourself, or you could, if there's a security researcher you trust, like Wallet Scrutiny or whatever, and they have like reviewed and approved that they've independently verified that software. On iPhone, you can't do that because of Apple. You could jailbreak your iPhone. So it's possible that a security researcher could jailbreak an iPhone and prove that, yes, it's also reproducible there. So the phones, I'd give it that a thumbs up. But then on the BitKey device itself, yes, all the software block is written is open source. But the fingerprint sensor is a third-party vendor, and sadly, they have like contracts with the government, and they can't open source their software. Like even if they agree with Block and want to open source it, they can't because of government contracts, security contracts.
So it's possible that there could be malware in the fingerprint sensor software that could impact the key generation.
Yep.
So anyway, there's trade-offs with all these different products, but I mean, getting back to advice to people who still want to self-custody, I don't think self-custody is dead. Multisig has legs still, and I think we'll have legs forever, and it keeps getting better user experience. And then doing off-chain, or not off-chain, offline entropy generation for key generation, or entropy using offline entropy for key generation is, I think, super important. Is that for everyone? That's a harder call, right? Do people have the time and patience to learn the process and then the diligence to follow through in that process in a safe, secure way? For people who have a lot of Bitcoin, I hope the answer is yes, because it's important enough to them, but unclear. But for those that can commit the time and diligence and patience, then you can generate your own entropy. And if you're confident in that process, you can sleep much better at night than solely using some third party. Because even if the software is open source, as we just learned, it could have bugs. The vast majority of people can't go inspect the code themselves and effectively audit it.
Right.
I mean, I guess
they could have their agents do it.
They could have their agents do it now. The only thing, I think we're quickly moving into a world where the vendors themselves or Project Loops of the world or other security experts are going to be scanning all the software with LLMs. So there's no marginal value to a retail customer doing
that. To do it themselves. I agree. But it's good they have the option.
Yeah. So I think those are the...
I have one other question, which I guess is kind of probably the best thing I was reading here. And I know this will be less popular, but still I think it's just worth asking. If someone wanted to get the custodial route, we talked about the Rivers, Coinbases, Squares, Krakens, whatever of the world. If they wanted to say, you know what, I've had enough of this for now during the transition, I'm ready to go IBIT. Do we know, have the rules changed on in-kind transfer of BTC to IBIT and what the minimum threshold you need is now to do that non-taxably?
I don't believe so.
It's not. No, it's only authorized participants.
Which is still
like Jane Street.
So that's tens of millions of dollars or something.
Well, yeah, you have to be an authorized participant, which is a separate role from retail. So I continue to be optimistic that this will happen over some time frame.
Right.
But I think there's nothing that suggests it's imminent.
So if a normal retail user wanted to, I'm assuming if you had a large enough stack, you potentially go through the qualified participant, maybe. But for most retail users, if they wanted to say, I want to sit this out during the AI transition, you would have to sell and then rebuy and take the taxable event.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. That's interesting.
Well, and why not just move your coins to Coinbase? That's where they're going to sit anyway. ETF.
That's a good point, actually.
Yeah, why do you need a level of indirection?
Yeah.
And, or River, Cashflow, or others. But if you literally want the same protection, just move them to Coinbase. That's where they're stored if you buy IBIT.
I think the reason they would say this, and I think it's a fair question. The answer hopefully is the same for Coinbase, is that, so as an example, obviously you'd much rather have your coins back. But let's say in a case where, if Coinbase got hacked, in theory, they would figure out some way to pay back at least part of the fiat value of that IBIT, potentially more if it's BlackRock backed. So I think you're also thinking not only about the technological piece, but also the sort of the symptoms of
political.
Basically, these guys are too big to fail, which I know is the whole reason Bitcoin was created in the first place, was to stop that. But is Coinbase too big to fail yet by itself? I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. IBIT and BlackRock, yes, would be my guess. I'm just saying these are all different factors that people will probably think through.
Print more money.
Mm-hmm.
Just print more money.
That's what they'll do. It's a cynical take, but
Coinbase has 2 million coins hacked and it's $200 billion or something.
It's probably too big to fail. But I mean, BlackRock, we know is, right? So probably, I don't know. I'm just saying that might be one reason.
But Black, I mean, this is a small portion of their business.
Yeah, exactly.
So they could just be like Bitcoin, go away and then move on.
But you don't think they would make their users whole, at least in fiat? If let's say Coinbase got hacked.
I'm just saying, underlying shares. I don't know. I'm skeptical U.S. taxpayers would bail out BlackRock for their Bitcoin customers.
Well, they
because BlackRock's not going to fail.
Right, that's what I'm saying. So BlackRock may not even need that piece. They may be able just to other funds somehow.
Or just be like, sorry.
Or just be sorry. I mean, sorry. Yeah, it's possible.
I'm sure it's in their prospectus, or you can read the terms and it says this is a risk, right?
Yeah. So they'll just. I'm not saying they're going to do either way, but I'm saying it's.
I would guess if I'm look at like, well, you know, if we think Bitcoin still has legs and we want to be in this business and it's going to cost us $1 million and it's not that bad, yeah, let's make our customers whole or make them happy or give them pennies and a dollar, do it's right. But if it's like,
it's the whole.
If it looks like Bitcoin's over with and it's going to cost us.
Well, I doubt that would be the case.
$100 billion, then I think they just conclude like, sorry.
Yeah.
Do we know which, like, I know that Coinbase is a major custodian for a lot of the ETFs. My understanding is some of those are moving towards more diversified underlying custodians, but do we know much about where like BitGo or Paxos or Anchorage may show up in other exchanges? They kind of provide more diversification.
Like which exchanges use Paxos or BitGo, et cetera? Yeah. I don't know.
Because that would be another way to achieve.
I do remember back in 2017, I think at Curious Conversations, some exchange owner was there and had like a ledger necklace around his neck. And like he's like, yeah, these are the keys to the exchange. And I'm like,
are you serious? he was joking.
He didn't.
You're not talking about the guy who got his Ethereum.
No, that's a different case. Yeah. Yikes. Anyway, I hope we're beyond those days.
I hope we're beyond those days too. And again, like I do think, you know, just to be fair, when people are always like, well, the exchanges, like they've all gone on. It's like, it's true, but like the exchanges have also come a long way since Mt. Gox and like even 2017 era. Like it's a different breed now. But again, I do think, and I think we called for this, you know, way back in the custody episode, but some kind of wallet screening like project, which I think you launched or someone that you helped launch to look at the different exchanges. And I think
the wallet scrutiny team put together like a prototype.
Yeah.
I don't know if that ever.
This is like exchange scrutiny.
Yeah. And it would be super cool to see that come back, but with even more detail now. So it's like, all right, what exactly for your cold storage setup? Is it just you doing self-custody? Do you have other exchanges brought in? What kind of models are you getting access to? How frequently are you running them? Like these are all things I would be very interested to see.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do think your call for like services and products and brands too. To be transparent, mark what they have. I mean, it's similar to proof of reserves. Yeah. Like proof of reserves is also not bulletproof. There's gaps in it, but like everything else being equal, I'm going to choose the vendor that has that service and describes how they use it. And it's definitely a win.
Yeah.
So anything else to cover?
I think, you know, as I think NVK is famous for saying, secure your Bitcoin, like it's worth 10 times as much as it is because someday it might be.
Yeah, I mean, I know we didn't get to today. There were a lot of other crazy things happening in the world. So some, you know, while there's been turbulence in Bitcoin, believe it or not, there's also been turbulence in the AI world too. So maybe tune in next week. We'll have more to say on that.
Yeah. All right. Cool.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks.
See you guys. Bye.